this is April 30th, 2004, and I'm Kara Buick here with Babette Babs Clough.
Right.
Clough. And we're at the 71st EVAC reunion in Salt Lake City. So, just start off and tell me where you were born, where you grew up.
Okay, I was born in New York City, grew up on Long Island, had a miserable childhood. Alcoholic parents, major, lots of abuse. So one of my goals, I think, in getting in, it sounds crazy to get in the Army, but it was to just get away from New York and that area. And I went to nursing school with a lot of resistance from my dad. He did not want me to be in anything professional because our family, I don't even remember anybody going through college, period. So I was like one of the first to do so. And I just knew I was supposed to be a nurse. In fact, I had a vision when I was two that I was supposed to do this. As far as being in the military, I don't think the vision was quite that complete. But I knew I was supposed to do something in the healing professions. And actually, I started out to be a baby nurse. And in the Army, when I finally did get in, I went into the Cadet Corps. Because that's the last year of your schooling, they give you, you know, a stipend monthly, and I just didn't have any money. I'd work as a baby, you know, I'd babysit or I'd go iron somebody's clothes or whatever so I could have tuna fish spaghetti, you know, because that's basically, luckily the hospital we worked in was a 3-year diploma school, which really threw you in the trenches immediately. You were not in books, you were in books and you were in school at the same time, and you were across the street working in the hospital. So we lived and bathed this thing called, you know, nursing. We had 19 in our class when we started. I think there were 13 left at the end of June. We had in February there were 17 classes, not credits. Everybody thinks credits, you know, but if you count up the credits, I don't think anybody would ever do that again. I know I wouldn't. I mean, if anybody told me I'd take that many classes, but some are coming and some are going. So we had finals and we had new ones. So the finals were like crash, you got to learn everything you can, try to pass the exams. And then the new ones had book reports and articles and publications to read and report on. And then we had at least a 4-hour stint at the hospital. And the hospital actually depended on us to be part of the staff. So even though we were carrying bedpans or giving our first shots, those poor patients, mine was in a coma, so that wasn't a bad thing. It was still servitude, literally. And there were times when we had a moment that we had, you know, R&R, so we could go to New York and see all the little goodies. But we were in Brooklyn, which is across the stream. And we watched the Verrazano Narrows Bridge built at the time I was going to school and graduated. And then when we graduated, we had to wait for our RN officially to be given, and it took until April. So I worked as a nurse from, and they knew that at the hospital because they were hoping to have us as, you know, people that actually stayed on for years going through this nursing school. And it was the Lutheran Medical Center. So there was somewhat religiously driven as well. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of courses in religion and different kinds. So at least we got to expand a little bit of our knowledge on what was in the world, et cetera. Let me think. And then we had the amount of time waiting for the RN so I could get into the military because I was officially a WAC. You know, when they go in as a student nurse. And at any time, they could have yanked us over to Vietnam. We knew that. Because if they needed personnel over there, but they needed nurses more than they needed somebody that did not have, you know, that capacity. So I lucked out and was able to wait until I got my RN, then went down to San Antonio, where most of the nursing, you know, boot camp was.
Mm-hmm.
And did all the marching and all the learning, etc. And we were then assigned, and amazingly, I got assigned to Killeen, Texas, which is getting a lot of publicity right now because a lot of the people from Iraq are going from that area and actually coming back from it. They were waiting for people to come back, but I guess they canceled it recently. So we supported tank divisions, and I was in the newborn nursery, of all things, and OBGYN, labor delivery sections of the hospital, and I was there for 2.5 years. And then I met this man, my husband currently, and we've been married this year, 37 years. We met at the hospital, and he was, I guess, one of the support, administrators. And when he and I were in, I think it was Michigan, we were meeting the families. They didn't come to us, we went to them after we got married. And of course, they thought I was pregnant, but I wasn't. And I really wasn't. We were just wanting to be married. We found out that he had orders to go TDY to Fort Sam again, which was about 200 miles away from where Colleen is. And that MOS that they were going to send him through was supplied. We knew he was a direct line to Vietnam. So we had to make the decision on our honeymoon as to what we were going to do. And my husband gave me the choice of, well, you could go back and live with my mother, or you can go to Vietnam. And I had met his mother and dad, and they were wonderful people, but I didn't think that was going to be one of the things, especially after my horrible childhood, that I wanted to go back into a family that could be, bossing me around again. And it's not that I don't mind direction, it's just, it was a horrible experience. So I decided to go to Vietnam. Is that nuts or what? Because at that time, supposedly, now I'm hearing from other people it wasn't. It was voluntary for a nurse to go over, but some of the nurses were sucked over there. So I guess I was lucky that I got to be on the mainland for a while and got some experience under my belt, really. And so then in the next few thousand, felt like months, I traveled back and forth to Fort Sam when I was off, and then my husband would come back when he was off, and that was kind of an experience all in itself, just driving back and forth. In fact, we had puppies. We had this dog, and she ended up being my mother-in-law's dog, because when we did go, we had to put her somewhere, and she had to have puppies by cesarean section because she wasn't delivering. And so I think I had 8 puppies and her that I'd drive back and forth to this until we got them old enough. And you should have heard the screaming in the back, those little puppies, because they didn't like the idea of driving in the car. And it was a neat time. It was a stressful time because I was working 3 shifts. They would put us, bump us back to, day shift, evening shift, graveyard shift, back to, evening shift. I mean, you hardly even knew where are you supposed to be when at times, but you were told what to do, and you just did it. And so it was kind of good to get away from all that nightmare after we finally got the orders we were going. I was supposed to originally go for a nurse practitioner, pediatric nurse practitioner, and I don't know if I regret it or not, but I didn't go because I got married instead. We were supposed to go in August to Germany on a buddy system. And there was another lady that I was supposed to go with. And so I dropped out of the buddy system and ended up marrying my buddy for life. And that was kind of, I can say that it was good. It was a good decision. And instead we went to Vietnam in June of 68. And I got into the military, full bore in 66 April. So it was a good, I think, good experience, just that part. Then we got to Vietnam, and of course we hit the ground, and I felt like crawling off the plane because it was so quiet. And they told us that there would be possibly, as we're flying in, there was rumors that we might be hit. I think we were in Saigon, and whatever base, it's kind of blur right now. We landed in, and the real scary part is we got in a bus, and the bus had bars on the windows. And I'm looking and I'm thinking, why in the heck do they have bars on the windows? And I had asked the bus driver, because I was just so curious, well, why is there bars on the window? They're afraid we're going to get out or somebody's going to get in. And he said, no, sometimes they throw hand grenades through the windows. And I thought, oh, now I'm really scared. And then we got over to where we were heading, the staging area, so to speak, and my husband and I were on the same flight, which was in itself a miracle. And they said they didn't know if we'd ever get stationed together because of the fact that, you know, they couldn't guarantee it. And yet we had been working on it for a couple months once we knew we were heading there. And they said, there's no guarantee. And we got on the plane, and there was another couple, and they had not even tried, and they were stationed together. So I was like, man, what did we do wrong? Why didn't we get, you know, because we had worked at trying to get it. And it's not like we were asking for anything. We were going to go over there and do what we were told to do. And when we were separated at the time, wherever we were in Saigon, for a couple days, and by some miracle, were put back on a plane that was heading up to the Central Highlands. When we got there, though, there was the alarm, the air raid, what do they call it? Like you have for a fire. Sirens. Yeah, the sirens started going off, and everybody started scurrying, and they go, get to the bunkers. And I'm thinking, what the heck is a bunker? I didn't remember the training in that part of it. You know, mm-hmm. I was like, well, I don't even know what a bunker looks like. So I just followed everybody, and we got into this, sandbagged area, and sat there and shuddered for about 2 hours, and there was nothing. It was a false alarm. So it was like you just lost your everything with nothing coming in or anything. So it was kind of tense, and it was a hard start just to be in country and immediately be told that we were going to be hit. You know, I thought, geez, I just got here and they're going to kill us already. So we got on the airplane headed for Pleiku when we got our assignments, and I found out that my husband had a different assignment than I did, and that was kind of a real heart-wrenching thing. And I was young, you know, and I really wasn't that secure in my own being yet. And it was kind of nice to have a guy that was a little more secure. He had been over in the Navy, so he had served already, just offshore, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think he had actually gotten onshore, and so he knew what Vietnam was like. I was surprised he wasn't shaking in his boots when mm-hmm. he got over there. And we flew in and found out that he was stationed about 20 miles away from myself. And so he was at Camp Anari, I was at 71st Evac. And the assignment was to, you know, work on the ward as a medical surgical, you know, kind of nurse and just do what we had to do. That was because the training I had as OBGYN and newborn nursery wasn't going to apply too much in Vietnam. So I kind of worked wherever they put me. And sometimes there were times when we had three shifts, which mean 8 hours, but it was rare. Most of the time we had a 12-hour, which really bled into 16-hour because we only had, I believe we had 2 to 3 corpsmen on the floor, and we'd have maybe one nurse, sometimes two, and we'd have at least 45 patients on the floor. And we were responsible for getting them in, getting them stabilized as much as we could. Of course, the OR, the ER would stabilize them as much as they could. If there was a real big push, we would actually get shrapnel wounds, burns, and that we had to stabilize because they weren't as life-threatening as some of the other things that went through the ER. And of course, there was triage so they could figure out which ones maybe the wards could handle. And we'd have to be pulling out shrapnel and suturing and that kind of thing, which was, something they'd never apply to now. You know, you go to ER, you get it taken care of there. But when you get 200 through an ER in one push, you just couldn't handle everything. So the wards were really busy. And we'd have patients coming in, and they'd have, if they came through ER, and most of them did, they'd have at least one IV going. A lot of times they'd have an IV, and they'd have a blood port going through as well, another IV area. Sometimes they have to do a cut down, which means they actually have to suture in the IVs because they couldn't find veins. Some of them had multiple you know, injuries. It wasn't just one thing. They'd have some, a few fractures. They'd have head injuries. They'd have to be stabilized by what they call a halo, and they completely stationary the head. And so our job there wasn't easy, and we tried to stabilize most of them. In fact, they'd have sucking chest wounds. They have just unbelievable, you know, stuff that you'd never see, I don't think, in the regular hospital over here in New England. The other thing we saw was, of course, a lot of malaria. We saw a lot of complications of malaria, which is called black water fever, things we really never would see. And then, of course, we have indigenous population. And of course, the first time we saw somebody come in, they just automatically had lice. That was just their normal thing. And couldn't speak a lick of English, so there was a bond you had to work at building to get them to understand you weren't going to hurt them, because I'm sure our image there wasn't the greatest. And we got to be friends with some of them, which I guess afterward wasn't such a good thing for them. I kept my head in the sand a little bit, not wanting to know, you know, what they did to some of the people that were supporting us.
And so your husband was stationed about 20 miles away. And
yeah.
Did you guys get to see each other?
Yeah, we saw each other infrequently. He was able, he was amazing. He was driven to get over there to make sure I knew that he was okay. We'd try to call, but they had to patch you through about four different links, almost like a ham radio or something, you know. And so one would go to Saigon, and they would go up somewhere else, and they'd finally patch in, and then you get to talk, and all of a sudden it was gone. But at least we got to know each other, it was okay. It was a little bit difficult, because sometimes we'd hear there was an attack on Campanari, and there were casualties coming in. And of course, my husband being over there, it's like, oh my gosh, please let me know if he comes in. You know, I'm going to be there. So that was always a big worry, and vice versa, because we'd get, you know, lobbed in on sometimes, but most of the time the stuff was coming over us, because we were surrounded, except for one area. There was Engineer Hill that was way far away, and there was this huge, gigantic terrain that was open. And so they'd set up their mortars there, which was pretty stupid. I don't know how we didn't secure that perimeter, but they tried, I'm sure. And lots of times at night, you would see, I think it was called Spooky, who would go through, and you could watch every 10th, and I'm probably way off on this, but 10th bullet that was going through, they could hit a football field in a matter of minutes, and every inch of it, and they'd come through and strafe that whole area. So they did some things to try to protect the hospital. Air Force was on the one side of us, the Army of Vietnam was on the other side. A little further down the road was the dust-off pilots. Further down the road was Special Forces. Mm-hmm. And so they were trying to knock off any of those, but sometimes they whoops and hit us. Now, unless they're mad at us, maybe they try hitting us. But most of the time we'd get to bed, you know, we'd be working that very long shift. And I think the hardest part is you'd stabilize them, try to get the vacuum in 24 hours so you'd get more in. And in doing so, A, you couldn't get to know the folks you were really caring for. So it felt like an assembly line. You know, so a lot of the folks and the guys that came through were like blur. You couldn't really get to know their names unless they were so severe that we couldn't transport them. You know, like the chest wounds, we had to stabilize them before they could go up in a negative, you know, kind of situation on an airplane. So that was a hard one. We also lost a doctor who succumbed. He thought he had the flu, and he and I had set up a theory. This was kind of hard on me, that I was going for pediatric, and that was my passion. In fact, when I had my little vision, when I was a tiny little one, I was going to be a nurse, a baby nurse. That was, you know, in a child's mind. But I was going to be a baby nurse, and for some reason I was in a foster home when I was that young, and I have no idea. I still, to this day, at going to be 60, I have still no idea why I was in a foster home, and I liked it. It wasn't a bad experience for me. The bad experience was going home to my parents, So there must have been something that went on, because my dad was a World War II veteran. And I think I was an oops that happened before he went over to the war. And anyway, getting back to being a baby nurse, there was this pediatrician that came on board, you know, came on to our unit. And he had heard that I, you know, enjoyed having the children on the ward. And we could figure out the titration, the doses of the medication and that kind of thing. We put all the blood boxes that used to come from the Navy that had ice and stuff in it. So they were like styrofoam. And we cut them up and made little bassinets for the babies out of it. And it was our way of, you know, treating the children. So we had a couple of them in storage, and we were able to pull them out when we needed them. And he came over and he says, "Hey, I heard you like kids. You understand, you know, how to treat the smaller ones. Let's make this ward where we send them from ER, because the other wards are going crazy because they get them on there and then they have no idea what to do, and I'm running around all these different wards. So why don't we just stay on your ward?" And I was excited, because it was like, yeah, that's really what I'm in nursing for, you know. And not saying that I didn't want to help the guys. I mean, I was there for whatever comes in, because when you're in nursing, humanity is your care. You know, you want to take care of whoever's put before you. So if it was a prison of war, we had at one point, we had 11 prisoners come in. And those poor guys had been beaten, maimed, and everything. One of them was dropped out of the helicopter, thrown out. We really mistreated, and we know that, and with Eli and that kind of thing. You know, some of the guys were very upset, and I understand that part, big time. But I also understand these are people, and they're just, you know, philosophically different, because they've been maybe brainwashed, maybe we're brainwashed, I don't know. So anyway, when the babies came on board, there was a mutiny on the ward after a little bit. We had one little boy that had been given, I think it was chloramphenicol. He had an infection of some sort. The doctor, Vietnamese doctor, had given him an antibiotic that had ruined his blood platelets, and he started bleeding out. It was Christmas Eve, and I think it really took, you know, it's hard enough to be there, hard enough to be taking care of this unbelievable kind of wounds that you just wonder if they'll ever really make it back to the mainland, you know, to their home. And then to have a child taking up a lot of your time. And we had one nurse that was one of the supervising nurses that had lost her boyfriend in a helicopter crash. And she was very bitter. So if there was a gook anywhere, you shouldn't be taking care of them, you should be taking care of the guys. And I don't know how many people have had that same experience, but it was heart-wrenching for me, because I was there as humanitarian, not as political. You know, I'm going to take care of my guys, I'm going to take care of the POWs, and I'm going to take care of anybody that walks in this ward, and little people especially close to my heart, because we can make an effect on these children. See, these white people are not bad guys, or, you know, these Americans are not bad guys, they're nice guys, you know, and maybe in their heart they'll know that when they grow up. So, you know, Pollyanna here. So the nurses had, I think that child put them over the edge, because he literally bled to death internally. His lips started getting to be humongous. The bruising on him was just awful. My husband came over and sat and rocked him, you know, et cetera. And it required a lot of time. And I suppose that was the straw that broke the camel's back. But because of that incident, I was called to the, it's just, again, a blur, but I was called up to the office and said that the girls did not want to have all the kids on one ward, et cetera. And what had happened to the doctor was sad, because he came in one day and he says, "You know, I feel awful." He says, "I think I've got the flu. So I'm going to go back to my hooch, and I told Dr. Da-da-da to, you know, take over my call. And he'll just kind of keep me up appraised of what's going on with the kids." And next thing I knew, he's being air-evac'd out and died on his way to Japan. He died of hepatitis. And he had, of course, thought he just had the flu. And it was so quick, it was just blew our minds. But it was then that the girls had like a hold on, I don't know who, but I was turned in, and that was a strike against my image that, you know, I don't know why and how they could support the, what do you call, mutiny, but that's what happened. So I lost my position as head nurse on that ward, and I ended up going to work on another ward because of that. So I feel like I was quite, I don't want to put it, ostracized, and in a way, for doing what I was told to do and what I was born to do, is take care of whoever. So I was not given the Bronze Star that most people were given because of that incident. So I still think, you know, in fact, it's a little bit emotional for me in a way. Not that it means anything. I mean, we've got the ribbons that we got and that kind of thing. You know, when, who's going to use those? They're worthless, really. I mean, I think it was Carrie. Was it him that threw them, some of his stuff somewhere? You know, what does it mean anyway? It's in the drawer somewhere. Who knows? Sometimes I fall upon some of the ribbons we had, but it wasn't a big deal. But it was a big deal because if everybody else deserved it and we worked ourselves to death and we did nothing, I didn't do anything wrong as far as I'm concerned. And then my husband was going to get it, and he showed up for his shift, which was an 8-hour shift, and supplied the place with, you know, supplies when he finally got to us, you know, 4 months later. And yet what we were put through, you know, I don't know if medals really mean anything, but everybody else got them, and I didn't because of something that I think we were meant to do there. So because of that, I think I'm a little bitter. I also think that it was an injustice in a way, and even if they offered to me, it's, what would it mean except it would exonerate me from whatever I'm supposed to have been incorrect in doing. And I don't think it was anything. I think it was because of this one nurse that was bitter because her boyfriend was shot down and killed. And then she created the stir that, you know, the other ones kind of caught on. It's like a pack of dogs that individually they wouldn't do anything bad, but there's a pack, so they do. So that was kind of my downside of the war, as far as I'm concerned. And we did have some interesting, like we went to play coup once or twice, and if I can find it, I've got it on a reel-to-reel. So it'd be kind of interesting if we could find someone to go from reel-to-reel to pictures, because we've got one where there was a truck that fell over, and probably the quality of the tape is pretty awful and there's no sound. But we went through play coup downtown, and of course they had never seen female. White people, actually I don't think there was any others but white people in our compound. We did have a couple of black, I think, soldiers, you know, that were supportive, like Corman. But it just shocked the Vietnamese that, you know, what tall, you know, Americans. So they kind of followed us around while we were looking at all the various shops, and of course we were warned, don't eat the public food because you'll end up with problems. And that was another issue we had. We had not only lice, but we had a lot of, all of the population seemed to be parasitic born. And I still wonder, there's different kind of parasites, the kind that are in the bowel, but there's also kinds that are flukes that are microscopic. And that could be something that a lot of us have and don't know it. And there is some parasite things which I can get to in a minute. But anyway, we went and went to a couple of different areas. Like we got to see the lake that supplied us with the water. I forget the name of the lake. In fact, for a while they even had like a motorboat, and we had heard, we didn't do it, but there were some folks that were water skiing on the lake. And what was a shock to me was the hospital and how wonderful it was. I mean, it was structurally very sound. We had grass, we had, you know, ditches where the water would flow through. Whoever engineered it was very thoughtful in the way they put it together. We had a swimming pool that was put in just before we got there, and we were there 68, 69, and we were thankful for that. I mean, it was like a little bit of normalcy in a way, instead of just completely, like I saw on the shore, There was just basic nothing. I mean, there was a beach. Cameron Bay was pretty, but it was also, when we were going flying through there for R&R or for leave, we went to Hong Kong because we wanted a little bit of the world, because we felt like we were camping out for for how long, you know. In fact, they finally put an officers' club in while we were there and had such a thing, and they'd have hamburgers at least. Mm-hmm. But I guess we were just talking down at breakfast, and they said there was some bootlegging of our food. So there was one week I remember hot dogs every single day. And we thought, there's got to be another place we could eat. And so we went over to the Air Force, and they always had steak and lobster and all kinds of wonderful things. And that was just a drive away. We weren't allowed to drive anything. You had to have a driver and request a truck, but we most of the time could dig something up. Mm-hmm. And one night, this was great, went down to the Special Forces, because they had pizza. They actually made pizza, but it was like Chef Boyardee pizza. Mm-hmm. At least it was pizza. Mm-hmm. So we went down to get a number of people pizza, and my husband and I went, and there was this other wonderful little driver that gave us total respect. I mean, the guy was just incredible. He says, I'll be right here waiting for you. So he parked the Jeep outside of the compound, because he wasn't allowed to drive into the compound. And we walked in, ordered the pizza, and then all of a sudden the alert goes off, and they said, you got to get out of here now. We can't have dead personnel on our that don't belong here. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, why in the heck is that the rule? You know, that sounds nuts. But they were actually, there was like, the Special Forces were there, and there was a field over on the other, across the street, mm-hmm. and there was mortars flying in, hitting the ground, and we thought, anytime they're going to hit us, and we thought the Jeep would be gone. I thought he'd be back at the compound. He was sitting there waiting for us. I mean, shaking and glued to the steering wheel while we flew in, and it looked just like a war, period. I mean, it showed us what it, you know, we were really in the midst of a war, because most of the time when we heard the mortars, we were under our beds, or maybe we were in the ward and trying to secure the patients, but we generally didn't have it as bad as some of the other locations, like Kuchi. I had another girlfriend there, and they were always having to take the patients. Sometimes they were so severe they put mattress on top of them, mm-hmm. to keep their lines in. So that was one of our exciting evenings. Another one was we went over to it was called, I think, Transportation Division, and I think they had something to do, and I could be confused, but we went over to another club so we could eat somewhere else, you know, because we were always looking for something that, you know, if you look up our pictures, we're pretty skinny. Because most of the stuff, it was terrible food. Just, you know, one guy was mad at us one time and he put pepper in our Jell-O. Oh, great. Well, this is good. And then the milk was filled milk, and I have no idea what it really was, but it was pretty gross tasting. But we went over there, and then we came back, and one of our friends, in fact, she's here, I won't mention her name, got really looped, and we're having to hold her in because she was taking up the whole back seat, throwing, I guess she said it was paper plates. I thought it was toilet paper, and she was throwing it out the thing. I said, they're going to find us. They're going to know where we go because you keep leaving a trail. So that was fun. But and we had a volleyball court, which we used about halfway through. Of all things, I just love my washing machine because we had the mamasans washing our clothes, which was nice because then we didn't have to spend our one day off, if we even got it, washing and housekeeping. They would come in and do most of that. Some of the people let them clean their rooms too. We didn't do that because my husband and I got, when he finally came over four months later, we got two rooms, and we busted a wall between the two rooms, used the two beds, and made a king-size bed out of it. And it was a lot more comfortable than a twin when you're sleeping with somebody that's 6'4". In fact, the first jury rig we did a string with a blow-up mattress to extend on the twin bed, so at least we could sort of have a decent night's sleep before they started mortaring us. And he'd end up about hanging on the string in the morning, you know, you see them about halfway down the bed, hanging on the string, and I have to yank them up. So that was quite a time, and we had our first anniversary there in August. We had been married August 4th, so the hooch, I think that was just before he came over, made a cake, an anniversary cake, and it was made in one of those fry pans, mm-hmm. electric fry pans. Mm-hmm. Never knew you could make a cake in a fry pan, but they did it. It was amazing. And so we started gathering things. In fact, when we went to Hong Kong, we brought back bags. In fact, we had them shipped to ourselves. We were grocery shopping in Hong Kong and got all these cans of stuff. I'm not sure who got our hooch afterward, but we had painted it blue instead of the, you know, whatever the wall colors were at the time, so it made it a little like home. And we had his mother used to send us a whole bunch of stuff from home, too. So we left quite a legacy, I'm sure, when we left, because we still had plenty of storage. I think to this day we're like that. We still have storage of stuff everywhere. So there's more of it. Do you have any questions?
How do you think you were treated in the Army as a woman? Did you find any stigma, or, I mean, even before you left, what did people think?
You know, the one thing that was kind of interesting, well, because you're an officer, so I thought I was treated well. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of times the guards, the MPs at the gate, that wouldn't salute us. They'd turn around and scratch their nose or something and wave us through. Or whatever, that might be the only thing. Other than that, I think we were treated with a lot of respect. I didn't have any difficulty with that. In fact, a lot of times they would actually take a second look because they weren't used to seeing women officers. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was a positive experience, mm-hmm. not a negative. Except for the ones that were couldn't understand why a woman would have a rank, you know. Mm-hmm. In those days, I think that was, you know, it was a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm. Was that something that drew you to the Army, that you could be an officer? Or why did you join the Nurse Corps?
I went and looked at the Navy, mm-hmm. as because I was going to be a Navy nurse. I didn't, this is crazy, but I didn't like the uniforms. Mm-hmm. And then I did go through, and I don't remember the facility, but I went through a facility in Long Island. And I decided I was going to be doing paperwork only, and Corman did most of the nursing. Mm-hmm. And I was, I am a hands-on person, not somebody that likes to do paperwork, because I'm quite dyslexic, now that I find out. I mean, the worst part of our Vietnam experience was the charting. You know, I could take care of the IVs, make sure they were as in order as we could. We didn't have any pumps like they have now that can meter how much is going in, but and it was nuts. I mean, if they bent their arm, they would stop. And the supervisor would come in and yell at you because the IV's not on time. I'm thinking, at least the IV's in, you know. Don't give me trouble for that. Mm-hmm. So the paperwork was always a problem for me because of my dyslexia, I think. And so when I found out the Navy nurses, that's mainly what they were, supervisors, I didn't want that. So I looked around, and I liked the uniforms of the Army. And so that was what drew me. The Air Force required a bachelor's in nursing, and that would have meant, which is stupid now, but would have meant another year before I could get in. And I'd have to go through more schooling. And with my dyslexia, I was happy to have B's and C's, and I got A in physics. So I really wasn't, you know, wanting to be any more into the trenches, like, you know, as far as scholastically. Mm-hmm. I just want to get my hands on and help people. So that's why the Army finally was the only other that I knew of. Mm-hmm. Maybe I could have done some other things now that I think, you know, of all the other things that are available. And I did like it. I thought being an officer was much better than being say a specialist, first class, or, you know, whatever, private first class, that's what it was.
Had you thought about civilian nursing at all?
What's civilian?
Just working in a hospital in the United States.
Well, the reason I didn't was because I needed the money. So the Corps had offered the cadet program, which would help me get through the rest of school. As I said, my dad did not want me in nursing school. My mother was wonderful because she, in her, that way, she was able to help me get a loan. I don't know how she was able to do it, but I think she had a job in some kind of a fiberglass place or whatever. She has subsequently died of heart failure, but she had other, you know, health issues, but I think that was one of her contributories. Plus, she smoked like a fiend, too. And I'm sure it hurt her lungs quite a lot. So heart-lung relationship. But she was the one that kept me on course. Well, I kept myself on course, but she was the one that I kept nudging, and she was the one that would bend for me. My dad said, well, you're just going to, you know, if you get it, you're just going to get pregnant and be at home anyway. Because that was his, he's Italian, and that was their way of doing it. My aunt never left the house. My, you know, everything in the Italian thinking is that you just have children and you stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a little different than what I had envisioned of my life. Mm-hmm. And so somehow I got it, and because of my mom. And but I still, they didn't have a lot of money, and so I had to somehow be creative, and the Corps was the best for me. Plus, I wanted to get out of New York.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to stay there. I had this vision of having a, and I finally did, a mailbox at the end of a long driveway with critters, and horses especially, and I think the only way I could do that is to get out of New York, because of course I didn't realize upstate was as beautiful as it was. I could have probably somehow figured a way to go work up there, but working in the, you know, straight hospitals wasn't alluring anymore to me, and I didn't know what I wanted really. And I think the good Lord just kind of threw me exactly where I needed to be, because I love Texas. I was just amazed. I got down there and I was like, wow. I leased a horse. I got to ride. I had a really good friend, Susan Bork, and she has subsequently died. She was over in Cucci, but she got married and then went over a little later, but I'm surprised she wasn't killed, because that was a horrible place to have to be, from what I hear. They were in worse, they were more intense, where we had hooches, which is more structurally something. You know, when it rained, you didn't have the tent collapse on you or something. So, and I love Pleiku. Pleiku, I did get to see some of the coastal places that they worked, and I thought we had one of the best units, you know, that I could have chosen. Like I said, I just felt like, wow, the good Lord's taking care of me. Plenty of good angels running around protecting me. And there were times when we thought this is the end, or we might have to be evacuated ourselves, you know, and I kept thinking, well, what are we going to do with the patients? We have so many patients, you know, they have to evacuate. And I would think we were like the captain on the ships. They would want to get us out last, you know, get those patients out first. So, anyway, that was how I got in the military, just because it was financially much more sound. I just didn't want to stay in Brooklyn the rest of my life, which is what it would have been otherwise, I think.
Did you talk to a recruiter, or did you just go and sign up and on your own? Did that person come to your school and talk about it? Do you remember that at all?
I went down. I went to a recruiter, and I looked at my options a little bit. And as I said, I had looked. I was pursuing it because, you know, it was either the Navy or that. And I had some friends that had boyfriends that were up in the academy. It's upstate New York, and I forget which academy now. 37 years ago, or 38 years ago. It was a long time to remember all these details. A couple of them actually married out of the academy, some of the guys. And so they just went to civilian life. Became wives of the officers, and I thought, heck, I could become an officer without going to that academy. And it's had a lot of publicity lately too on how they're treating the women. So I don't, you know, now the name do you change. Yeah. Anyway, I think it was a Naval Academy.
Did you? What was your husband's rank?
I always outranked him. I was, I think, about 6 months ahead because they were advancing this pretty quickly because of the people, attrition, who were going out. So when I met him, he was a second lieutenant. I was a first lieutenant. Mm-hmm. And then I got my captain bars, and he got his first lieutenant.
Uh-huh.
And then I think he got his captain bars over at the hospital where we were in Vietnam.
Uh-huh. Was that ever an issue or even a joke?
Did it was
he
a
say
joke.
Much about it?
It was a joke. He says, she always outranks me, and now she's a civilian. Now she really outranks me when he was still in.
Uh-huh.
And then the part that I really wanted to get to, you know, in the interview was the medical part, because I really feel the Agent Orange has played a very heavy role in my health.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I was alerted to that only in 81, but up until then, I had had chronic, I mean, I was operated on in Vietnam on my right nostril to open up the passage because I couldn't breathe, and my allergies were just horrific. I had sinus infections a lot. I had chronic bronchitis. There was a big push, of course. It was quiet, deader than a doornail, so the one doc had said, well, why don't we do some surgery on your nose? It's a pretty minor surgery. Of course, I almost died from the anesthesia. I couldn't breathe. My lungs had locked up. And the push had happened, so I told him, I'll leave. I'll go back to my hooch. Luckily, my husband was a little bit on the flexible side for the way he operated. He had, you know, because he was a supply officer, he could have some of the folks working with him keep him appraised, and he stayed with me 24/7 until, you know, I started coming out of it. But I actually thought I was going to die, not from being shot or hit by a mortar, but because of the anesthesia. And they have checked me for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and at first they said I had it, and lately, because of my herbal direction, I've actually changed in the way I think about, you know, the body, and have gone into other directions, just because I felt like I wasn't getting any answers in the traditional Western medical philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I had spinal arthritis. Got to a point my husband used to have to pull me out of bed, and he was the healthy one. I lost my first baby. I lost two other pregnancies. I found out another lady that I was in the unit with, she also lost her first pregnancy. They said it was a possible folic acid deficiency. We do know folic acid is a big thing now. But I have a suspicion that it is Agent Orange, considering my husband and I both being over there. We both had, you know, terrific exposure, from what I understand. You know, we didn't know, actually go bathe under the spray or anything, but the folks came in with it on their outfits and that kind of thing, and apparently it's quite easy to get. So, dioxins of all kinds. I remember going to the mess hall one morning, and there was a guy spraying right there, and the mist was hitting us, and that was malathion. He said he was spraying. For mosquitoes, to keep the mosquitoes down because of the malaria scare. And of course the malaria pills made us really ill as well. So we were walking around half there because we were so sick from the whatevers, not realizing eventually it's going to pay more of a toll on our life. I forget when I actually stopped. I actually had no voice as of, I know, 93. I could not talk. I was evaluated finally in Minnesota at the VA hospital there, because I was wandering all over the country at that point. We had been in Michigan for 11 years. We went to Reno for 5. Then we went to Hawaii for from 86 to 93. And then was seen periodically at the VA. And by the way, I think the women anyway are treated very well at the VA. That part I have to say thank you for, because I've heard other stories from the guys, though, that they haven't, you know, so I'm kind of disappointed that, you know, in a way we are singled out and the chosen one, so to speak, which is nice, but it's not nice for the guys. Anyway, they said there was a nodule. They said if they would do any work on it, they could cause me never to have a voice. So I said, well, I'll leave it there and I'll just try to do it my way. And so literally, it's been a journey getting my voice back. So just to speak today is an honor. Not to have pain in my back is a miracle. And and I used to have chronic headaches. I mean, I could probably identify five different kinds of headaches that I'd have, and it was very difficult to get up in the morning. But I ended up having three live births. The first one used to have ear infections chronically, and they'd never seen it so bad. They said that she was like a chrome above having a bubble. Her immune system was so bad. The next one had asthma, and very, very severe. We almost lost her a couple times. In fact, my first one was spent her first birthday in the hospital with a sinus infection, and oh, by the way, she also has pneumonia. And so she really suffered. They had to do like quarter doses of immunizations on her because they couldn't, we never had a well day with her. And she was hyperactive. I told my mother-in-law once, "Do you ever die of exhaustion?" And I thank God I lived near her. She was a great model for me as far as how to be a mother. She was a really wonderful lady. And she took over where I could go take a nap. So a lot of times I'd go over to her house just to get a nap and sleep for 4 hours. That wasn't a nap, it was a nice sleep. The second one was born 4 years later, and she was like an angel. Although her respiratory stuff didn't start till a little bit later. But she started showing some problems as well. I was worried about her, and we did almost lose her a couple times, but I was more worried, sounds crazy, about the older one, because she was so hyperactive, and with these ear infections that the doctors kept saying, "I've never seen anything like this." And she had six sets of ear tubes. She had twice a tympanoplasty, a brand new eardrum put on, and she has a huge mastoid bone hypertrophy, meaning it's swollen back there all the time. And everybody kind of dismisses it, but oh no, that's not normal. If you look at everybody's mastoid bone, you don't see that. And my last one had leukemia. He was born with a high fever. We were in the hospital for 8 days. They couldn't identify what the problem was. Went home, and at age three, this one doctor finally said, "I think there's something really wrong. This guy has high white counts. They're not high enough yet for us to treat, but he's got leukemia. And he's on his way to, you know, life-threatening kind of situation." And my advice, and she was not going to stay very long, she was in Kaiser system, she says, "I would find an alternative way to do this, because all three of the kids is strange in your situation." At least she looked at us as a whole, because everybody was looking at us individually, and all I did was spend time. Thank God my husband had a fairly good job, and his health wasn't too bad at the time. Now he's falling apart. We went to different people. Nobody identified it as Agent Orange. I identified it as Agent Orange. And I'm sure possibly it's because of compensation, et cetera. I just want answers. I'm not looking at the compensation part. I'm looking at what can we do for these kids. And I'm sure it's throughout our whole, I would like this weekend, in fact, it should be throughout the whole hospital. There should be some identifiable common ground with a lot of these kids. And, you know, maybe because my husband and I both were exposed, there's going to be a larger incident in our family than there would be, and maybe half of the kids wouldn't be troubled because the father was not, or the mother, well, I mean, this is Vietnam nursing, so it would be the father we'd be looking at. So I'd kind of almost like to have, or be part of, a study. It's a little more than just the neural tube issue, because they were saying if you had somebody, you know, anencephalic, well, you wouldn't have a child without a brain, you know, or spina bifida. That was the other one that was studied and said that is directly related. Now they're starting to say it in laryngeal cancer. I started working with alternative doctors. As I said, I've been literally, I believe, led to the different doctors now that I've had the honor of working for. And one group, and I'm back to working with them. I worked between 84 and 86. I'm now working with one of them that's an alternative cancer doctor. And he's worldwide. In fact, you can look it up on the internet. It's drbrodie.com, B-R-O-D-I-E. And his philosophy on how cancer actually happens in the body. And it's not a one thing. I mean, you can have a viral, you can have a chemical. So chemical is a stimulant to produce cancer. And I just heard at breakfast a couple of folks that have gone from cancer. Now, it's not just going to be one kind of cancer or the kind they're identifying as a cancer. If you have lung cancer, you know, and I had lung problems, I mean, severe lung problems. I've had 5 pneumonias, you know, that they can identify, and asthma that I've got under control because of herbs. I don't take as much as I can. I stay away from any medication. If you come look in my room, you'll see herbs all over the place. And I'm a walking herb because it works for me. You know, and I think I can direct people to the kinds of things that can keep their body at least functioning at an optimal level compared to the way I operated before. I mean, I couldn't even take medication. If I took pain medication for my arthritic back and my arthritic hands, I'd be vomiting. And I have worse headaches because the medication would cause the more, you know, even more intense. They were so crushing, I thought I was having strokes. So, you know, would you do that? Not me. Not anymore. So I'm not one for aiming for the drug direction. And now I'm watching what I call miracles. My son, we were delivered in this doctor's office that was doing electrodermal type of screening. And it's kind of an energy medicine, but it actually measures the acupuncture points of the hands and the feet. Mm-hmm. And so you have, like taking your car in to get your oscilloscope checked, you have a way of monitoring the body and see which systems are screwed up or off. And after you determine them, what kinds of things, be it herbs or homeopathics, and you could actually put in medication too, would help stabilize that meridian. So it, A, would not be freaking out. B, maybe drain it. Because I think the liver is probably the largest stressor in the whole body. So the liver has to be cleared somehow, up, and the chemicals, you know, being Agent Orange, and then once your immune system drops, anything else that jumps in. So you'll have virals, you'll have fungals, and there is a theory of pleomorphic changes, which means this cell, that's supposedly a normal cell, will change into a virus, which then will morph again and change into a fungal. And then the fungals can change into the cancer cell. Very fascinating. And it's we're doing so many things in medicine right now that is so new and cutting edge, and everybody's poo-hooing it, but it's starting to become general knowledge, like the stem cell research, coming from your own nasal passage to make a implant on a spinal cord and create healing. I mean, we have things that are coming right now that are so exciting, it's almost like you want to hold on so you don't float away. So we have ways, I think, that we're going to be able to help. What we're finding is not just get data, let's do something about this thing. So today I sit here and my back doesn't hurt. My hands work, no problem. I look, I don't think I look 60, maybe I do, but my one girlfriend just told me I look like, you know, on my pictures that you see in the thing. You can identify who I am, where some of them, I looked at them and was like, who are you? I don't know who you are. So I practice what I've been researching. And I'm very fortunate to be in a clinic that is looking at anti-aging as well as these really disastrous chronic diseases that we have no answers for. And to me, you know, I went on and got more training. And what really cleared my head and actually changed my dyslexia to a moderate instead of severe, maybe even mild, was I went through acupuncture oriental medicine training. So I've got my bachelor's and master's, which I never would have thought of. When I got out of nursing school, that was it. I was never going back to school. And to have the treatment I had and then to be able to have the clarity of mind is like a miracle. It really is. And there are things I've watched that have been told, you have lupus, you're dead. You don't have any, you know, you've got to stay on the steroids and get all the chronic diseases that that causes, like kidney shutdown, osteoporosis, all the horrid things. Look at poor Jerry Lewis and what he looks like now compared to what he looked like before. So there are ways around this other than drug people to death. And I think the understanding of our science background has been what's led me to the next step that's sort of too cut and dry in a way. The herbs have been here forever. The Chinese having a 5,000 year track record, of just observing. They didn't have much to do. They didn't have computers and TVs, so they had to do something, just observe. And what they've observed is just unbelievable, if we just listen to the old ways. One of the other things I did was went to a medicine man, a new medicine man, that helped me a lot with my voice. And then one other real interesting methodology of changing the energy patterns in the body. And it all sounded like spooky, weird, foo-foo stuff, you know, too far out there. But when it actually affects you and the health of all your family, you got to start sitting up and looking at it and saying, okay, then how can I tell other people? And I think one of the things I was here just to observe in a way this time, I hope we have another reunion so that we can get, you know, once I, like you're gathering data, I need somebody that would be willing to do a research project, and I'd like to help coordinate it or assist it or contribute to it or something. You know, I don't have to run the thing. I don't really have time anyway, because I've got now a practice that people come see me because I've learned how to do the electrodermal screen, check the systems that are out, and help them correct them. And I've got plenty of people that would tell you that I've saved their life more than once. And it's only because someone saved mine. And I'm walking and thinking and getting up in the morning, and before I could sleep till noon, 2 o'clock, and I could probably sleep 24 hours a day. What a waste of a life. And now I can get up in the morning without the alarm, you know? To me, that's like, wow. People do that.
Uh-huh.
Never would have thought that before. So, anyway, that's my mission, I think, now. And I've got a very active practice. I had over 5,000 patients in Hawaii. I feel bad I'm not there now, but there are other practitioners, and they're, at least the door's been open for them, so they know there's another way. I think I want people to understand there's another door, and they can go through that one, and they might regain some of their function or some of their health through that door. Doesn't mean it's going to cure, because I don't believe that there's a cure. I think that you can live with whatever it is, you know, because there's so many heads to this, and there's so many dimensions to this wellness that we all have.